Welcome back to another episode. Today I am talking to the amazing Chelsea Pottinger, who's an international well-being speaker, ambassador for mental health organizations like Are You OK Day and the Gidget Foundation. She's authored a book, The Mindful High Performer. Her passion is helping busy minds reset, recharge, and navigate the challenges of everyday life. She's been featured on Channel 9, ABC News, Marie Claire, and Women's Health, and works with many high-profile clients like Westpac, eBay, Estee Lauder, Google, etc. She's the founder and director of EQ Minds, who empowers people to take control of their mental well-being, be more efficient, resilient, and happy. And the thing that I found most interesting in our talk was how burnout affects so many areas of our life and how she came up with this kind of 3-day check-in rule, having a break for 3 days that will give you a lot of answers with regard to, is this kind of chronic or is this something else or is this, I just needed a reset. So I hope you enjoy the chat. Lots of good things in here for optimizing work performance, finding what's driving our constant pursuit of achievement, and also some communication skills, of course, because that's what we do in real conversations. Hope you enjoy. So, Chels, you've done a ton of work in corporates on high performance, some incredible names and logos. You're someone that really understands the potential trade-off of caring about people and driving good business outcomes and showing that they don't need to trade off. Also, how people can live full-fledged careers and do great things and not have to at the expense of their own personal anxieties and potential depression, etc. This has to come from your own lived experience, which you've spoken about previously. But can you take me back? There are some parts that I don't know. For example, the role that your head injuries have played. When's the first time you felt, oh, I think I have bad mental health?
Yeah, it's a really good place, I think, for us to start, Mitch. You know, a couple of things that I think that have contributed to my mental ill health was, the first time was 2010. I was down skiing with Jay and his family. A snowboarder slammed into me, which left me kind of lying face down in the snow, unable to breathe. He sped off. Luckily, my father-in-law was kind of skiing down behind me, and to make the situation more terrifying probably for him was that I began sort of convulsing when he turned me over to get oxygen in from his vasovagal attack. And that incident left me with a concussion and some broken bones, like broken ribs. And then coupled with that, 2013, I was running a bag of rubbish down the stairs, and I fell down the stairs and whacked the back of my head onto the stairs, and immediately I had another vasovagal convulsion attack, and my brother and my husband Jay found me because they'd obviously heard the crash outside. And then an ambulance came, picked me up, took me to the hospital. I had numerous tests to determine the extent of my injuries to my brain. And to be honest, Mitch, you know, the doctors are like, well, from the tests, like everything kind of looks okay. That was on a Saturday. Right. As this high performer, like just maniac, on Monday, I go back to work, right? After having this injury on Saturday, I'm back at work on Monday, and I drive through the Harbour Tunnel. And then suddenly I have this, I couldn't breathe. I'm having like this peripheral, vision was kind of narrowing down. I was really scared that I was going to cause like this big car accident, like a 20 car pile up in the Harbour Tunnel. I managed to pull over. You know how they got those shoulders in there. I jumped in the back seat of my car and just trying to breathe. And even though I couldn't see and I felt like the tunnel was kind of caving in around me, I could hear just these commuters zooming past, and they were just unaware, right, that there's this woman in this SUV having this like panic attack. And then they sent the emergency team down. Security arrived because from all appearances, there's an empty car parked down in the Sydney Tunnel. There's no one in the driver's seat. They're concerned it's a threat. So then they just see me in the back of the car, just like laying down, breathing, and just said to them, you know, I just, I need a moment. And they kindly just towed me out of the tunnel and they drove me home. But that incident, because it happened within 48 hours of falling down the stairs, I went back, right, to Prince of Wales Private Hospital to get some more tests done. Like, I went to see my neurologist again. I said, you know, something's not quite right with me. And he said, nothing looks suspicious on your scans. And he kind of just sent me on my way. And even though that they couldn't see it from the brain scans, from the particular ones that they did back then, you know, something was clearly wrong with me, Mitch, because I couldn't get back in my car, knowing that I had to commute back through those harbour tunnels. And I knew there was something wrong. My husband, Jay, knew that there was something wrong, and my GP knew it. And then I was referred to a psychologist who acknowledged that what I was experiencing was, you know, severe anxiety. Was it due to the head traumas? I think so. You know, I think the brain, you know, the brain is this magnificent organ, and but it's so, so soft. Like, it's soft, like the consistency of soft butter. And then the skull is really, really hard. And in order to protect the brain, there's many sort of sharp bony ridges inside which hold our brains in place. And then when you hit your head, like how I did, your brain kind of bounces around, right, in this skull, like a whiplash injury, or your brain collides with the inside of the skull, causing damage. And while some people, I feel, develop these symptoms immediately following a traumatic brain injury, others find their symptoms, I think, that emerge over a period of weeks or months as a result, right, of that delay, the underlying cause of the symptoms. And it's kind of forgotten about, or it's never uncovered until kind of these symptoms like confusion or memory problems or anxiety or rage or angry bursts or poor judgment appear like a few months down the track. You know, I was one of the lucky ones that my therapist got onto it straight away, and she really helped me with gentle exposure back then. So I had 6 sessions with her to help me get back into driving the car. And, you know, being this sort of high performer, like type A human, I'm like, I need to get onto this as quickly as possible, because I didn't have time for severe anxiety that prevented me from not doing my job. So it took 6 sessions with her, daily cognitive exercises, Jay like driving me through the tunnel multiple times a day, and then me doing it by myself, like cheering myself on. And then I was kind of able to overcome my anxiety about having anxiety, which I know sounds hilarious. That was the first insight to me of the lens through an anxious person.
Wow. What a story. And I'm so glad that you have used it to fuel your mission now, and that one of the benefits, I think, of being a high performer is that tenacity and that kind of never say die, must move forward, must achieve. And I guess you borrowed from that a little bit to be able to look into your treatment plan and say, well, I've got to take a step forward. I've got to move toward the hard part. Because for a lot of people, once an experience that acute happens, all we do is avoid. But the consequence of that is our world shrinks further and further and further. And then the anxiety fuels the anxiety. So I guess that's a long way of saying thank you to the high performance part of you that assisted in your recovery. Did you ever know anxiety before then, or my experience with a lot of high performers is there is a general sense of non-ease, that if they're not diagnosed with anxiety or depression or OCD or eating disorders or whatever, they often experience a reflective, when asked about childhood, an unease. Like, nothing ever felt fully comfortable and peaceful. There was always this like agitation away from something and maybe towards something, but it's usually away from something. Can you relate to that at all?
To be honest, Mitch, for me, the only thing I reflect on with my childhood that could contribute to, you know, my anxiety, then more so with postnatal depression, like significantly, where I ended up in a psychiatric hospital really unwell, was more the perfectionism that came from the type A kind of personality. And I think, you know, I've got these very, I've got great parents. One is like the nourisher and just really gentle and loving and kind, and the other one's the driver, where if I didn't get an A plus on the piano exams, it'd be like, well, you know, I'd get an A minus. Like, well, where's the A plus? Like, you know, and I feel like that kind of stemmed this, nothing's ever good enough. I've got to tick, 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 tick. And I'm a middle child. So I'm always like trying to, you know, look at me, I'll try and, you know, pave this different pathway. And so I didn't realize that I was someone who suffered perfectionism until my psychiatrist kind of picked that up when I was in the hospital with postnatal depression and anxiety. And so, you know, it's one of the most wild things to me, Mitch, is that I had those experiences there with that car, with the, you know, with the harbor tunnel and the skiing incident. I didn't even think to mention that, right, to my doctors when I fell pregnant with Clara, you know, that I would be someone who'd be vulnerable to perinatal anxiety and depression. That didn't even rear its head because I was just so excited and I was so unaware. Like, it's kind of, for me, I reflect that going, oh, that's, you know, you just so weren't educated or empowered to know what it was. So when you fell pregnant, that you are very high vulnerability, right, to go through this. And also it's very strong in our genetic lining, you know, like the anxiety and depression is very strong through our gene line. And all those kinds of things I didn't even investigate, you know, when I fell pregnant. So to say when I was younger, did I have ill ease around? Not really. Reflecting back, I was always a really happy kid and a really, really confident kid. However, there was that very strong perfectionism element to my personality that kind of I figured out later down the track.
Yeah, so there maybe was this sense of not being enough unless XYZ conditions were fulfilled.
Mm.
Do you relate to that?
Absolutely. I can absolutely relate to that. Yeah. And it's like that whole sense of working harder, you know, making sure that whatever I put out to the world is 110%. I mean, this has all changed now. It's taken me 7 years to recover as a perfectionist with a lot of therapy and a lot of like investment into myself. But yeah, I think that's right.
What's been the single greatest thing, and we'll deep dive into it more, but I love oversimplifying things where possible. What's the single greatest mindset you've had to change to move from a perfectionist where it hurt to a fully embraced Chelsea who seems to strike a very good balance? What's the number one mindset you had to either gain or let go of?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The one thing that really has helped me with my perfectionism, particularly, right, Mitch, with the line of work that we do, is that I take the massive pressure off myself these days of when I get up on stage and I might be with 8 people or 500 people or 5,000 people. And I always think if I can help one person inside this room, one, just one, help them to empower them to take care of their mental well-being, and also stop someone from falling into hospital where I ended up, that is such a successful day. And so what that mindset shift has done for me is actually taken the pressure off myself. And it really, really helps around, you know, battling sometimes with those thoughts that we have around, oh, you know, I'm not a PhD psychologist yet, and I'm not, you know, this. But you know what? We have lived experience and we care. We have passion and a desire to help people. So I think when you get outside of your own head and you do something for somebody else, that's where it shifts.
Yeah, agree. And I think what that mindset represents is the need, or I would say the let going of the need for this to be the biggest thing in the world. You know, if I really relate to this. Some of my perfectionism is driven by must be bigger, must be better, must be faster, must be harder, stronger, etc. And I think when you come back to a focal point of one person, what I believe that does is it shrinks ego and it removes a lot of, because ego is perfectionism essentially. You know, that they are born from the same territory, which is a want for social esteem and status and validation. But the one personness is incredibly humbling, and it's reduces your almost in some ways, and I think you'll know the way that I intend in saying this, any type of narcissism becomes vacuumed out when you go back to the one-on-one aspect, even when you're in a one-to-many role. And mm-hmm. I also find that really helpful. I actually have someone in my OneNote, a picture of them who has a name. They live overseas, and they're a friend of mine. And I have their name and their face. And I whenever I get overwhelmed, I say, this is who you're doing it for. Don't forget, this is your one person. And the one person test can be applied, I think, for anyone in a growth position who's trying to achieve, to so that at the end of the top of the mountain, this group of people are there with a marching band being like, how good was that? When you remove the marching band at the end of the mountain and you imagine yourself as just climbing along the path with another person who you're helping, I think a lot of the bite gets taken out of the drive, but you're still left with the good ingredients of the drive. Would you agree?
I love that. Mitch, that is such a beautiful way to say that. I absolutely agree. It's a beautiful place to be, I think, when you can contract that ego and that whole place of serving someone else makes you feel also bigger. You know, we're part of something bigger, a bigger collective, when we're actually just out there helping one person at a time. But I really love how you've just positioned that. And yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Even with surfing these days, no ego. You know, like I just get out there. Someone wants to drop in on a wave. I'm like, you go for it, my friend. Good luck. I'm like, I'm just here to have a good time. Just get some 2-foot glassy waves and I'm here to have a laugh, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just such a beautiful position to be in. I think it also helps with the people who get caught up in comparing themselves to others. And, you know, I just think when you're just doing your own thing, know what your purpose is, it's okay. And then you're more complimentary to everyone else who's out there having a go at things too. It's just like, good on you, mate, for doing that. Like, I'm so proud of you, rather than being in a bit of a toxic headspace of, well, what are they doing? And I've got to get their competitor, like they're my competitor. And I just find that particularly in our space that we work in, we're here to, if there's more people doing what we do, Mitch, there's a bigger pie, which means that there's more people getting help, which means our human collective is getting more well. And I'm like, what an awesome world that would look like if there's just more people out there helping each other out. And so I think when you're from that place too, you know, it's just a healthier mindset to be in for sure.
Agree. Yeah, achieving is such a double-edged sword. Like, there's so much goodness that comes from wanting to achieve, but there's also a lot of tax to pay. And I find that the thing that's helped me most outside of mindsets like what we just spoke of is learning how to find the peace that sits underneath the clinging. And my therapist and I, we do these somatic visualizations where there's a big part of me that's like, want to help, want to achieve. And to be honest, selfishly want people to tell me I'm doing a great job. But then if we just like drop away from the stories in the mind, and actually if I tap into my body and he's like, is there anywhere under there that is feeling like things are okay, just as they are right now, if nothing changed? And I'm like, Yeah, I can tap into something remotely akin to that. He's like, okay, I just want you to like rest in that for a second. And the more and more I sit in the part of me which is genuinely feel safe, and that there actually already is enough. Like, I have enough money. I have enough therapy under the belt. I have enough friends and family that love me. To some degree, you know, heart on my sleeve and my speaking career and everything else, have we helped one person? Absolutely. So whenever I'm in that part of my psyche, I'm like, oh, like it just becomes so much more circular. There's not the tension and everything on top of that. It's not like I'm ever going to stop striving, but the striving is so much more enjoyable when it comes from a place of, I'm already enough. This is good. And I'm going to take steps forward, as opposed to, I will only feel peace once this mythical objective in the future is achieved.
Yes, to that, 1,000%. And you know, my mum had always this beautiful quote on her fridge, and my mum's just the most beautiful human. And it was, you know, how can you be happy with more if you're not happy with what you currently have? And I've always remembered that because, like, we were raised in a pretty low socioeconomic area of Albury, and but we had so much love in that family household. And I remember COVID hit, you know, and she called me and she's like, "Oh my gosh, is your business going to be okay? Will you survive this?" And I'm like, "Hey, Mama, remember how you taught me always be grateful and happy with what we have?" And I said, "You know what? They can take the house. They can take the car. They can take all this window dressing. This is material crap. As long as I don't lose my family and my health, we're going to be just fine." And that's an always place I reflect on, that you're right, like, we have enough, you know. And I think because we are both learners and we're servers and we love this stuff of what we do, right, we'll be on the journey for a very long time. But it also just helps, we don't have to flog ourselves like 52 weeks a year. You know, I work 40 weeks a year to take proper scheduled breaks with my friends or my family, because that's my life journey. I want to enjoy myself while I'm doing this job too.
Yeah, the enjoyment while doing. I think a lot of people who burn out are perpetually in a future state as opposed to a current state. And I know that, like, the only reason to burn out, I believe, is if you're genuinely fighting for survival. If you burn out beyond that point, then it's ego. Something insecure is driving that pace. So nothing on the outside world is ever going to solve it. That's an inside-out job every time. Like, you're running from something, or you're waiting to feel enough for something. And even when that comes, trust me, as someone who's walked that, it's never enough. It's a drug, and it will make you work harder and harder and harder for it. What do you see as someone who works every day with people who are high performers and are more subject to burnout than others? What do you see as some of the reasons that drives people to that point?
Yeah, it's a great question. And Mitch, I think the main reason, I always feel like it comes down to one word, which is lack, right? There's a lack of focus on themselves. There's a lack of boundaries. And so they just don't know how to say no, or they don't want to say no, or they're in that strive mode. Or there's a lack of a awareness where they just don't know. Burnout can sometimes be cumulative, you know, it kind of sneaks up on us. And I always feel like, why do we go from, you know, feeling great, right, feeling really good about ourselves, on top of our job, on top of our game, loving our hobbies, loving our mates, loving ourselves, and then that feels good. And then the next day we can barely drag ourselves out of bed, right? We're like low mood, brain fog, low motivation. We get to work, we have like 5,000 coffees, nothing seems to help. We then get home at the end of the day, exhausted, flop onto the couch, smash a bottle of wine, watch Netflix, eat a tub of ice cream, right? That's kind of it. It's this weird pendulum that people will swing between. And I think, why do we do that? I think the truth is, as well, is that we can't see the brain, you know, like, we can't go around going, you know, "Mitch, far out, mate, I can see you've got about 40% left of serotonin there. I think it's probably time you go book in for Bali again." You know, we just can't see that. So unless you're dialed into yourself and you've got that awareness and you see these little signs that are starting to sneak up, then it's really, really challenging to know when it's here. And people will say to me, you know, "What's the difference between feeling stressed and exhausted to feeling burnt out?" And there's usually three clinical dimensions, I say, at uni. One is just sheer exhaustion when you have nothing left in the tank. Like, you know, when you're having a coffee and nothing seems to give you the edge, like, you know, when you're just so tired and people try and consume more and they're just exhausted. Number two is cynicism, right? They get cynical towards their job. They get cynical towards the people in their life. They get cynical towards the world, the new, everything, right? Everything kind of starts getting a bit more of a negative lens. And then the third one is reduced sense of accomplishment. They just can't produce in the same kind of way. And there's some pretty easy adjustments that I think that people can do when they're starting to feel like they're burning out, but they have to take that accountability and discipline and ownership. And one of the things that I feel like has helped me, that my psychologist and integrative doctor and psychiatrist, and we talk about this stuff all the time, is this sort of 3-day rule where you take a Friday or a Monday off. Obviously, due diligence, everyone listening in, with your job and your role. But if you can take a long weekend, And all you, and that's the reset weekend. It's not the time to go on a bender with your mates, right? Like, that's not the time to light yourself up. It's the time to actually nail your basics. You have to prioritize your sleep. You have to eat clean. You have to, you know, do some kind of gentle movement. It's not like pounding the pavement, flogging yourself, marathon running. Self-care, any kind of form of that, what that looks like for you. Is it the ice bath? Is it a massage? Is it just reading a beautiful novel on your balcony, having a cup of tea? And then, like, just limit as best as you can things like the alcohol. In fact, I would say just wipe the alcohol out for those 3 days while you're doing that reset, because alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. So it's also going to impact our deep REM sleep. Therefore, just like cut the booze for those 3 nights. You know, coffee, I'd just scale back the intake just so you're not getting hectic withdrawal symptoms. So if you're having like, I don't know, 4 shots of coffee a day, maybe just scaling that back to half. And then I'd just say, hey, remove yourself from social media and the news just for those 3 nights. And that's because, you know, social media, there's a lot of causational data out there around us being on it for a long period of time and the impact on our mental ill health. And then also people feel like they get FOMO. They're looking around at everyone else having a good weekend. We want them to experience JOMO instead, which is joy of missing out rather than fear of missing out. And then the news, right? We see Dr. Daniel Amen talks about 14 minutes of negative news is like really impactful on our anxiety, our stress. And as we can imagine, right, with what's going on right now in our world, like we are in so much pain because we're feeling it as a human collective with what's going on over there. And so just eliminating those kinds of things for 3 nights, right? And then when you get back to work on the Monday, if you're still feeling like you are gassing hard and you're like, I'm still not recovered, I would really encourage people to get on the phone and call your doctor. Go get your blood work done. Go and check in with your therapist, right? It could be something there lingering in there, maybe a low on vitamin, I don't know, vitamin D or low iron or low vitamin B12, or maybe there's a lot of stuff going on up here. So go and engage with your therapist and you know, have a chat to them. And kind of they're the next sort of accountability steps that we can do to get ourselves back. But what a lot of people do, I think, Mitch, is they feel like they're getting exhausted and then they're like, you know what, it's the weekend, and they just blow a gasket. They go hard socially. They go hard on working out. They might do some work over the weekends. And then Monday they just turn up still completely shattered.
Yeah, I feel that. I feel that for sure, because when you're low on energy and you're staring down the barrel of burnout, you're looking for dopamine rushes and hits to be able to make you feel better. And the problem is that usually those result in pushing you further down the bad funnel. I like how you frame that. Do you think 3 days is kind of the magic test number? If I take 3 days out and totally try and reset and that doesn't stick, then something else is at play. Yeah.
That's what I see for sure. I think 3 days is a good amount of time. I mean, get a fair few long weekends in Australia, you know, that could be a good time to reset yourself. I think 3 days is a good amount of time to turn things around. And I'd say to people, like N=1, right, in science, like try it out, see how you feel. But I see a lot with thousands of people that we work with that they'll take the 3 day, they'll reset themselves, they're disciplined. Right, they're not sneaking in the glass of wine. They're doing things gently. They're just really honoring their body. Really interesting, you know, that dopamine reward where we're trying to get external validation. This is when we need to be okay with ourselves going inward and just being, right, and noticing what's coming up, doing journaling if that's kind of your thing too. Things that we know that really nourish up the system. And then on Monday, yeah, if things aren't looking okay, just give the doctor a quick call and get your dashboard checked. You know, our body doesn't lie to us. And it's really important that we kind of work out what's going on. There's this cool thing called My DNA Life. Have you seen it, Mitch?
No.
Have you heard about it? It's a pretty cool, I think I'm not sponsored by My DNA, by the way. I better mention that. I just think it's a really cool test. And my husband and I did it 6 months ago, and you just get it from the chemist, and it's like a cheek swab, right? And then you send the sample kit. From memory, I think it's $130. And you send a sample kit down to Melbourne. There's geneticists and doctors down there, and they analyze your DNA for you. Now, people who are listening right now, just make sure you tick the box, right, that says don't store my DNA, because we don't want people storing our DNA data. And then the next weekend, they start unlocking data about your genetics and DNA. So really interesting stuff came out about me and Jay. So we're away on a weekend and we're just like listening to each other's data. And I'm like, this is so true about me and you. So for example, are you someone who can metabolize coffee pretty quickly? Does your genetic coding allow that? So I've got a gene that metabolizes caffeine really quick, which means I can drink coffee all the way up to 2 p.m. without it impacting my deep REM sleep that night. Jay doesn't have that gene, so he needs to cut it at midday. Sleep fragmented gene. This would be interesting for you too, Mitch, I reckon. So sleep fragmented gene, if you have that, I have that. So what that means is that if I get woken up in the middle of the night by Clara, by our puppy when we're training her, and I had disrupted sleep, in about 2 or 3 days, my mental ill health will rear its head, right? Sleep for me, I need a quality 8 hours of uninterrupted deep sleep. Now, my husband doesn't have that. He can have disrupted sleep the whole way through. And even though he may be tired, it doesn't impact his mood. And that is so true. We see it with the both. And I remind him of that every night, like when we're sleep training our daughter or our puppy. But it's really interesting, right? Learning little things about yourself. Like my body doesn't manufacture iron and vitamin D, and they're the building blocks, right, for serotonin. So every now and again, I need to supplement with iron, vitamin D, and I take a serotonin reuptake inhibitor for my anxiety because genetically I've got a really strong vulnerability there. So I just think it's just getting a bit of more of a snapshot, isn't it, of your body and working with it rather than working up against it. And we're just also unique with our genetics. So I thought that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I'm definitely going to look into that. I've done the 23andMe, which tells you your heritage, but it tells you random stuff like you're more likely to have this hair color or go bald or whatever. But I would like more functional things like what you were talking about. Do you have an enzyme that breaks down coffee and what time would be preference to stop? I think that'd be really helpful. But your point around your biology is permanently trying to give you information. So just find out a way to hack it or to listen. That is key. And it's funny, like you mentioned the word sleep. It's such a term that everyone talks about, but it is so critical. I'm dating this lovely girl at the moment and we joke that I have narcolepsy. That's probably not a very PC joke, but I am obsessed with sleep and I protect it at all costs. And I told her, I'm like, during the night, she wants to cuddle. I'm like, please, no cuddling. When we're conscious, cuddle away. Before and after sleep, totally cool. But if someone is rolling onto my side and then like goes to touch me or grab me, that's going to wake me up. That waking up is going to have consequences on my mental health. Like I've done a lot of work, but there is a couple of things that I must protect, and sleep is one of those things. It is like top three. If that goes, the whole system unfolds. So I'm like, you know, obviously at the start, that's a pretty personal discussion. She's like, why don't you want to cuddle? I'm like, this has nothing to do with you and everything to do with my ability to get up and help people the next day and or function and have any type of serotonin.
That is so true. Mitch, you're going to love this. So my husband and I don't sleep in the same room. We just do not sleep in the same room.
Oh, that's my dream. That's my dream.
Oh my God, it's gold. It's gold. And, you know, like it's, because of my sleep, right? And Jay is 6'5". He's really tall. And I'm 5'11", so I'm really tall. And in a king-size bed, that is a lot of human real estate taking up that king-size bed. And Jay snores a bit and I fidget, right? So I can move around a lot. And when I've been married to him for like 16 years, so I've seen his face a lot. So I'm like, mate, you just sleep in the other room so I can get, and we're still really intimate. Like we have such a loving marriage. I love this guy with my whole heart. However, he knows how important my sleep, and he loves it, right? Because he sleeps really well. So we both get a good 8 hours and then we just speak really nicely to each other the next day. And I'm so happy that we're talking about this because it's such a taboo topic, right? No one talks about, like, I can't even imagine if I had a date again and someone's like trying to, if someone tried to wake me up in the middle of the night also to have sex, I would lose my actual shit at them. I'm like, you do not understand.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Do not break the cycle my sleep for anything. Yeah, totally.
For anything. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a hard discussion to have, but it does relate to everything we're talking about with regard to burnout, mental health, and performance, because your sleep is your recharge to get up the next day and perform. And I've often spoken about how, like, my dream scenario is to have a bedroom of my own, bathroom of my own, wardrobe of my own, which doesn't just meet the sleep criteria, but also meets the OCD criteria. There is still some part of the world that I have complete autonomy, self-determination, and control. And then the rest of the house, let's integrate and blah, blah, blah. And I believe my hypothesis is it builds intimacy because it allows some a healthy space, just like how a fire grows with more oxygen. But yeah, it's not an easy conversation to have in the early days of relationships, but I think that's a fun little side thought during our discussion, just around different non-traditional modalities of keeping burnout at bay that might not be as socially acceptable or practiced, such as splitting rooms. I think that's a good footnote. So I just before we move on from this 3-day test, because I really do like this as kind of a foot in the water to see if this is something that will self-rectify and it was just a break needed or if something else is going on. People know that the number one way people describe me is real, which sometimes means I like to challenge limiting beliefs. An example of this is the B word is banned from my friendship circle. Like, no one's allowed to say I'm busy, because it's like, fuck, everyone's busy, right? If you're over the age of 21, you're busy, you're trading units of time. So another thing I believe is people who say, I can't do that or fit that in, and it's like, bullshit, with a little bit of planning and foresight, you can. And I can hear people saying, oh yeah, imagine me actually taking 3 days off to myself to read. I have children, I have a job, I have blah, blah, blah. So can we just break some limiting beliefs right now and say that it is possible as someone who's in the position of all those things?
Absolutely. Everything's a choice, isn't it? And I think the whole thing around this is like that whole restructure of prioritization of whose health is the most important. And I come up against this all the time. You know, Chels, I'm too busy to take time out for myself. I'm too busy to go for a massage. I'm too busy to take a holiday. I'm too busy to fit in 10 minutes of meditation every day. You know, and Mitch, we both are very time compressed individuals, right? Like, we both have very, very crazy schedules. And I think it was my psychiatrist that really helped me reframe the game on this in terms of people who feel like they don't have the time, right, to actually invest into themselves. And so she said to me when I was leaving the hospital after my 5-week stay, and she's like, you know, Chelsea, I want you to think about this really strongly. If you feel like any day that you are not investing into your physical health, your mental health, your emotional health. So she got me just to lock it into my calendar schedule, right? Because to-do lists are good, but what's even better, I find, is putting it into my calendar, because if my team sees a break, right, at 12:30, when I'm meant to be meditating for 15 minutes, they're going to lock in something else for me. So they see that, you know, 12:30 Chelsea's got a meditation with herself. Do not overlap that time with anything else. She needs to recharge her brain. And so circling back to the psychiatrist's advice was, if you don't look after yourself every single day, if you get sick, and for me, Mitch, you know, other people might get sick and they get the flu, right? Your body has a different way of expressing how you get sick when you're stressed. Or for me, hands down, mental health relapse, right? Whenever I get really crook and I push myself too hard, or I've been taken off medication, and I've had 2 relapses since my diagnosis of postnatal depression, I will have a mental health relapse if I get crook. And she said, so who does it impact if you get sick? And I said, well, it directly impacts me, right? I have to go down and out for a good 4 to 5 weeks while I get back on a medication. I rebuild myself. It's kind of like a sports injury. I literally have to double down on all the self-care that I know, cancel everything, like all my social schedules, all my work, and I just bang, I'm really investing into me in those 5 weeks. And she said, well, that's not very fair to you, is it? And she said, but who else does that impact when you're like that? and you're taking those four or 5 weeks out. And I said, well, it directly impacts my daughter, Clara, and it directly impacts my husband, Jay. And she's like, is that fair to them? Like, do they deserve that? Do they deserve this stressed out, burnt out, anxious mum? And I said, no, they do not deserve that. And she said, every day from now on in, Chels, you're going to take care of yourself every single day and schedule it into your calendar. And that was a real light bulb moment for me, because sometimes I feel like, Mitch, you know, people struggle to put themselves on top of the to-do list. So if that's you, then I want you to think about someone else that you love more than yourself, and you do it for them. And it's such a great intrinsic motivator to get you across the line. Like, I hear all the time, you know, parents will say, oh, I'll die for my children, I'll die for my kids. And I always think, but would you get healthy for them? Like, do you want to walk them down the aisle? Like, do you want to be there for that graduation? You know, this is like changing the narrative and the mindset of like, how are we going to intrinsically motivate ourselves so we don't end up there?
So well said. Would you die for them, or would you get healthy for them? That is such a great reframe. I love that. And yeah, I have found so far that coaching people towards self-care, the greatest motivator is helping them think about it, a lack of it, as selfish, instead of doing it as selfish, because really you're the last one to experience the consequence. Everyone else will be pulled down in the process with you and often before you. And so, yeah, if you're too busy to avoid burnout, then you're going to be too busy repairing burnout, essentially. And hopefully that starts to sink in, because it's one thing to be like, yeah, I get that. It's another thing to actually just do the things you're supposed to. Just fucking do the things you're supposed to. I don't know. Like, there's a million ways we could say it, but ultimately it just comes down to do the things. And we're all guilty of it. I was supposed to do this parasite cleanse 6 months ago, and I was like, oh, it's Are You Okay Day. It's World Mental Health Day. It's like, but. And then eventually I was like, hey, dude, just do the thing. Just stop drinking coffee and carbs and sugar and everything and start taking these supplements. Do it 4 weeks. It'll be done. And now that I'm in flow, as much as it's hard at the start, I'm like, I'm happy I'm doing the thing. And I got a calendar on my fridge that I've printed out analog. I know, very non-millennial of me. And I have a highlight around day one, a highlight around day 30, and I cross it off every day so I know I'm 1 inch closer to freedom. But sometimes it's just biting down on the mouthpiece and getting shit done.
100%. And, you know, like, it's just that just extreme ownership, you know, like when people are – It's really hard, right, when you're dealing with people who victimize themselves in their life, and but they will not take the ownership of just making these small, simple changes to take care of themselves. And, you know, when you were talking about this on our podcast recently, when you've been on the rodeo a few times of mental illness, we know, right, where we slip to. So we are very motivated to not slip back to those darker places. And our whole mission is to stop people from ever feeling that for the first time, like ever going down that sort of mental ill health path. And so it's just, you know, it's that whole thing of like, you're the one, like it's in our power. It's if you don't take time every day to look after your wellness, it's that whole thing. You will be forced to take care of your illness. That's just how it is. Like, if you do not invest into this, that's like how I see people who flog themselves waiting for their retirement, get their super, bang, day two, retire, heart attack, dead. And I'm like, oh my gosh, right? Like, this is your vessel. If you do not take care of this vessel, you have nowhere else to live. Like, this is your home. If you don't take care of it, where else are you going to go? And like, I'm continually learning, Mitch, on this journey. Even for me, right, with the last relapse in 2020, my team, I've got the most epic team around me, a great psychiatrist, a great psychologist, a great integrative doctor, a great GP. They all keep me upright. And the last time that they tried to take me off medication and I relapsed, we're like, okay, we now know for the rest of your life, you need to be on a SSRI. And I'm like, brilliant. Yeah. Don't ever take me off this thing. I bloody love it. I can function like every other human being. Yeah. I'm like, we've learned our lessons. Do not take me off this drug. And again, it's just that whole reframe of like, brilliant, now I know. It's just like this bright line. I know I need that as a part of my toolkit to keep me really healthy and well.
Yes. I'm also in the club of a forever SSRI person. I'm very grateful that I have found a dosage where there is optimal upside and very little downside. And the only reason I would come off it is because of ego. Some people don't have that. They want to come off it because of weight gain or sexual libido or numbness, all valid reasons. Mm. And I'm a big fan of titrating down before you look at a binary approach and all that other stuff. But you know, one of the things I respect about you most, Chels, as I get to know you more, is you are good at saying yes and you're good at saying no. Like, you're good at stating your needs. And one of the things I was inspired by on our last chat when I was actually on your podcast was you are good at not doing things that you could. Like, for example, if more work was there, if another speaking gig came up, if another workshop came up, but you're like, no, I'd like to just not work tomorrow, or I'd like to go for a swim this afternoon instead of taking that meeting. And that was really inspiring for me. And I've sat on that for the past few weeks. And I noticed that I had this inbuilt belief that if I can do it, I should. And then I thought, who for? And I think that comes like in full circle back to our perfectionist tendencies is, you know, I'm a big fan of the David Goggins world and all that, of just like, stay fucking hard, keep fucking pushing, you know, no days off, all that stuff. I'm like, yeah, I subscribe to that. I like that. But I think my personal opinion is personalities like that are good at dragging us closer to the middle. We're not actually intended to live at that extreme. It's dragging one extreme to the middle of people who probably are unmotivated and lazy and getting them towards a healthy middle. So, I'm a big fan of pushing and working hard and all that good stuff, but I'm also a big fan of, you know, the last few months I've been thinking, I am not taking advantage of the flexible lifestyle that I could have as a business owner and as a speaker. And, you know, part of it is I have a team, so I need to say yes to more work because that's what I have a team for and all that stuff. And so why wouldn't I? And then I've just been kind of meditating and sitting on the fact that, why do we say things just because we can? It should be because we want and we can. Putting needs aside, you know, when we're not in survival mode, it's not just because we can. It also has to be because we want. Do you think that ties to burnout? Is that we don't want things enough? We just can do them?
I think so. And I think also, we have this bizarre fallacy with death. Like, we feel like we're going to live forever. So we work so hard, and then we really don't have that much time here, to be honest, on this planet. Like, that's even if you make it to the average life expectancy, you know, into your 80s. And so I always feel like if I take these scheduled breaks, which we take every 6 weeks, we take a week off. Like, I've got all 2024 booked out, so everyone knows, the clients know I can't speak on those particular weeks because I've got a week off the grid, and I unplug from the world. No one can find me. It is the most liberating week of my life. People that I'm there with, they get a truly mindful version of me because I'm not on my phone or addicted to my emails or work. But I also find that unlocks a lot of creativity and innovation on those weeks off. And then when I get back in those sprints, like, I've got good energy, right? Because I'm taking those scheduled breaks. And that's been, you know, I think that that's an adjustment I've made over the last sort of 4 or 5 years of like, you know what? When I turn up for an event, they deserve the best version of me. And it's a lot of time that they're giving up. They're paying us a lot of money. I want to be really high value for them and give them the best that I've got. And the only way, Mitch, that I can do that is by taking these proper breaks. And also just reframing of that whole thing that we're talking about, that destination versus the journey, of just enjoying the journey and what we're on. And 40 weeks of work a year for me is enough. you know, in that sprint when I get back and I am on and hard, like I'm in Goggins mode for those 6 weeks. But then I know, you know, I've got light at the end of the tunnel, and you get the anticipatory, you know, that beautiful serotonin flush about 2 weeks before you go on a trip, because you're imagining yourself there. So you're already in a good mood. Don't you think? Like, even me just telling you about Bali with my daughter next month, we're talking about that all the time, and we're having a shower together, and I'm just super pumped. And that's like 3 weeks away when I'm taking her to Bali, and that's already making me happy, you know? Yeah, I think it's just a protection strategy, mate. Like, in terms of, just because we can doesn't mean that we should. We should be, just because we can and we feel amazing and we're like raring for it, then we do it. But to be able to keep that sustainability of that energy and longevity in this game, you need to be having, we all need to be having like scheduled breaks.
So speaking about can and should, Real Conversations is all about how we connect with people better, particularly during hard times, and knowing how to be a good supporter at work and at home. What is your advice to someone who is supporting another human through burnout or a perfectionist type tendency, a type overachiever person? What are some tips you have to connect with them more effectively?
Okay, so I think always when someone's going through burnout or they're going through a mental ill health, or is number one, unbelievable love for that particular person. So I always feel like if there's someone in your life that's experiencing something pretty hectic at the moment, the best thing that they need is just one person in their life, right? Just one person that truly loves them, that's there for support. And then it's easing their load. So number one, how can I help you out right now? You seem to have a lot on your plate. Can I drop you off a meal? Can I come over and look after your dog while you go out for, you know, do something nice for yourself? Number two, depending where they are, right, whether they're burning out or whether they're going through, they're spiraling into a mental illness, number two, hey, let's go see an expert together, right? We probably need to go speak to your doctor and speak to a psychologist or therapist to get us some really unique tools to help make this period of time a little bit more smooth. So that'd be number two, I would say. That'd probably be my main two.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the highlight there is, how do you ease someone's load when they're feeling burnt out? Because one of the biggest things is overwhelm. They're experiencing, I don't have enough time to get the amount of tasks or output done. So in our community, we teach, which I think is implied in what you do, but just to call it out to make sure that my guys are understanding, listen first and always show compassion. Well before we get into the actual fixing. But when it comes to fixing, I think doing things that reduce their load is a very good thing. For me, it's also about going back and inquiring why and where's all this drive coming from. So you're burning out, okay, you got a lot on, and I would curiously just kind of try and unpick the thread of what's the story you're telling yourself that's driving this volume and this pace. If I don't X, Y will occur. So once we get the X and Y, pretty much everything else is going to unlock and start to, we can work backwards from that and say, is it actually true? And or is that actually the right story to be telling yourself? Is it helpful?
I love that.
And for me, sometimes it's adjusting the inside out more than it is the outside, because let's address the cause. Why is this charge here? Why is there this bite? Why is there this must achieve, must do? Beyond survival, in my opinion, it is ego. So what ego validation are you missing that we might be able to find in a more healthy, sustainable way than 15-hour days for the next 6 months, you know? But what about companies, Chels? What are you seeing with companies? And are there any strategies and tactics that any of your clients do that are effective in maintaining psychological safety and preventing burnout, overwork, etc.?
Yeah, I think, and back to what you're just saying, Mitch, I love that, getting to the core root of the problem within, rather than a band-aid solution. I love that, the unpicking, the unthreading. That's so beautifully said. Love that. Mm. With the large corporates that we work with, what I see work well is I always think that it starts at the top, right? The leadership team. So if the leadership team are saying, hey, we value you, we value your health, your happiness here at this organization, we value your well-being. However, we're going to pepper you with emails at 2 a.m. and then we're going to send them on the weekends. That's a complete dissonance between
there's no integrity.
What are they valuing? There's no integrity, right? There's no actual alignment here of what they're saying versus their behavior and what they're doing. So the companies that do it really well, they start at the top with their leadership team and they create the culture there. Okay, let's start instilling some rules that the tools are down. Even if you are someone who is doing, say you're a night owl and you do your best work at 7, 8, 9 p.m., from now on, you're scheduling emails at 8:30 the next day. You cannot send the team emails at nighttime. Like, there's just like these blanket rules, right, that go out. So they're starting to adhere to take care of their staff. So there's some nice etiquette rules there amongst the leadership team. Then number two, the vulnerability piece. I think true leadership, having a piece of authenticity and vulnerability, whether it's someone, say we're talking about workplace well-being, where people are quite, someone's willing to open up, right, and talk about, maybe it's their lived experience, maybe it's sharing someone else's experience, and that builds that connection piece. Number three, then I'd say having, whether it's within the organization and they've got people who are people in culture, HR, who can do particular tools and stuff, or it's getting external speakers that come in that are experts in their particular space, and they come in and start giving really practical science-based tools to help that organization start to thrive. It's kind of not the one and done thing though anymore. You know, sometimes having a big keynote speech is great, but I think the continuum of, okay, we've done that, what's next? So we're embedding these on a foundational level over a longer period of time. It's things like having your dedicated, you know, EAP there, but encouraging people to utilize that. It's things like having people within the organization that have mental health first aid training. And so I think that corporate Australia are doing a better job. I do. Like, ever since I started up EQ Minds in 2016, there was no one spoke about it. Like, no one really spoke about mental ill health. No one really knew what mindfulness was. And it just wasn't a thing. It was like cup of cement, pull your socks up, harden up. You're a pussy if you say anything. You know, this is like some external companies that were sort of more in, anyway, I won't name who they are, but just a really different stigma around mental illness, right?
Yeah.
And I think the conversation's changed, which is brilliant. I really do think that, but I still think there needs more. There's so much more to be done in this space. How about you, Mitch? What are you seeing? I mean, you work in the exact same area. Like, what are you seeing that's being done well or needs more work?
Yeah, I agree with you that there's companies that are role modeling it and looking out over the long term sustainability as opposed to just a tokenistic gesture. Companies that are integral, what they say they believe in, particularly the leaders tops down, are showing that that is true. And I think, yeah, another thing that you touched on is workplace practices that become part of cultural norms that showcase that we're actively trying to mitigate psychological injury. We're not trying to burn you out. And one of the other things I believe in is managers who manage the person, not the style. So what I mean by that is you take a unique approach to every single person that is in your team and getting to know how they perform best. If you know that everyone in your team wants to do a good job, wants to contribute, wants to give you everything they have, i.e. they're engaged. If you know that they're engaged and motivated, then your job is to keep that happening at a person by person level. Like if I know my team member is better in the morning, not in the afternoon, then I will stop slacking them at 4 as opposed to 6. You know, it's not a blanket rule for mm-hmm. everyone. If I know that their mm-hmm. love or their care language is words of affirmation, not acts of service, then I'll make sure that I give that feedback. So getting to know that person on a deeper level allows you to bring the best out of them over the long term. And that connection is like glue, resilience glue against burnout, I believe.
I think you're spot on. We're just all human beings, right? We want to feel connected. We want to feel seen. We want to feel heard. I love that you aligned those love languages. That's super cool. You know, it's really interesting, Mitch. We have a policy at EQ Minds. It's not a public knowledge, but it's an unwritten company rule, and it's called the no dickhead policy. Yeah. That is any, you might have the same, but any company that doesn't actually believe in mental ill health, you know, I've had organizations, and this is a few years ago, where they're like, can you come over? You're the right look and feel for us. You're going to be great for the shareholders. But really, we think the guys are just a bunch of pussies, right? They just need to have a cup of cement. And I'm like, do you know what I actually do for work? I'm like, I'm so sorry. This is definitely a no. Like, it's a hard no for yeah. us. And then, you know, you fly home and then they quadruple the fee. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Has your attitude, has your values changed in the top leadership? Are they, you know, are they starting to get a bit more of an insight? No, they still kind of feel the same. It's definitely a hard no, because for me to be able to walk in there and know that that culture and that leadership team does not believe in it. And that really broke my heart, because, you know, later that year they did have a suicide within that organization. And I'm like, that is so horrific. And it's also like, I will not stand for that kind of like attitude and behavior. I'm like, it's such a real thing. And so, you know, we used to charge a tax that was a lot more money to work with us if you're, you know, just a bit of a pain and just also didn't believe in mental, but people don't believe in mental health, it's a definite no. But if anyone's just a bit of a pain to my team as well, it's just a no still, because your whole vibe, like you work with amazing human beings. Like I remember that company, I didn't go ahead with that company because we're like, no way, you just don't believe in mental ill health, like mental health. This is a no. And my husband's like, I'm really proud of you for knocking back that massive financial contract, because at the time we were still very small. And I'm like, babe, that's not what I'm doing. I'm so passionate about this stuff. So that door closed, but the next day, Estee Lauder, they called me, and we've worked with them for 5 years, and they are amazing humans and like good people. They hang out together. So if you are working with good humans, they then refer you to good humans. So I think that's just a good life philosophy anyway, like just 100. Hang out with good people.
Yeah, I think that goes a long way, is hanging out with good people. And I believe karmically, some people might not, but karmically, when you say no to the unaligned energy, it does feed back the right energy in return. Whether you believe that, I would bank a bunch of my career on whether it's called karma or luck or whatever, but being a good person now pays dividends later. But we should be doing it without the dividends anyway. So as we ties the knot on this conversation that has produced many dividends, what is the greatest piece of advice you've ever been given?
Oh, greatest piece of advice is from my mum. It kind of ties into what we're just talking about, actually. So my mum, when I received my first mobile phone, Nokia 5210, age 19, this thing was a brick. It like would overheat when you'd use it. Mm-hmm. Had no like app process, but it had just numbers and, you know, love it. I'm thinking about going back to that phone.
Yeah.
Anyway, my mum, she's like, darling, now you've got this phone. Every spring, September, so my mum's a minimalist, right? If you walked up into my bedroom, Mitch, like everything's just nicely hung up. It's just no clutter. It's better for my headspace, right? And so she's like, every September, spring clean your wardrobe. So from a sustainable environmental perspective, buy high quality pieces, less of, right? So just spring clean that every huge September. Fan. But also, huge fan. But also, spring clean your mobile phone. And I'm like, what do you mean, Mum? And she's like, darling, anyone that is toxic or bitchy, or when you walk away and you feel like there's a knife in your back, delete their number. And I'm like, wow, that's really hard. That's really harsh, Mum. And she's like, it might sound harsh, my sweetheart, but that is vital for your well-being. The people you keep in this life, they will influence everything. And I've never forgotten that. I haven't had to spring clean my phone for like 15 years. I've got the biggest amount of legends in my network. But I thought that was just pure. I mean, she's got so many pure gold moments for me, but that was one of them. And I've never forgotten it because it's just everything. Your network influences everything.
Spring clean your circle.
Spring clean your circle.
Yeah.
Love it.
I love that. Smart mama. Well, Chels, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. Where can people find out more about you and EQ Minds?
Thanks so much, Mitch. Honestly, I love what you're doing out there. EQMinds.com is our website. You'll find us on all the social media platforms. Chelsea Pottinger on LinkedIn, Instagram. Would love to have you part of our community too. And Mitch, so grateful to you, mate. Like, I'm so glad we've connected in this universe. This is gold for me.
Likewise. Friend for life.
Absolutely.
Cheers.
Thank you.